if we realize and recognize what fake toughness is, then what is inner strength? And to me, it's being able to, you know, if I was to simplify it, it's feeling any sort of discomfort, anxiety, or stress, and then creating the space to navigate it instead of just saying, hey, I'm just going to try and bulldoze my way through and grit my teeth and, you know, get on the other side of this.
Are you a busy professional who's crushing it in your career or in growing your business, but you're struggling to lose weight and transform your body while fitting in your social life as well as your work obligations? If the answer is yes, well, let me help you get into the best shape of your life while thriving in your business. Go to legendarylifepodcast.com/apply and schedule a 15-minute strategy call with me today. What is up, my friend? Welcome back to the Legendary Life Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Rice, health expert, coach to entrepreneurs, executives, and other high-performing professionals. Today, we've got Steve Magnus on the show. He's a world-renowned expert on human performance. He's also the author of the new book, Do Hard Things, Why We Get Resilience Wrong, and The Surprising Science of Real Toughness. Now, I don't know about you, but there's this conversation we're having in society right now where things are as easy as they've ever been in so many ways, but yet people are struggling, especially psychologically, more than they ever have. So it seems. Not only that, we have this epidemic of fake toughness where people act tough, but they don't do tough things. And I gave the example of going on a strict diet or doing the 75 hard when it's like, well, you should be doing something that you can do for 10 years because that's really the hard thing. So I'm about to go on a tirade here, and Steve and I really get into this because this is what I coach people on, and Steve just took it to the next level. So it's a really interesting conversation, but on a personal level, it really meant a lot to me as well. So you're going to hear a lot of what I believe in, and Steve's book, oh, you should go and get it. It's fantastic. You want to become tough? It should be required reading. And we talk about what the military is doing right now, because the military of all people there, of all organizations, I should say, they're getting it right. And they're using sports psychologists. They're at the cutting edge. So we talk about the people who are getting this right, and the military is one of those groups. Such a fascinating discussion. I bet you can feel my excitement. Without further ado, let's get into the conversation with Steve Magnus. Steve Magnus, thanks so much for being on the show today. Really excited to dive into this topic about doing hard things. But I think before we get into that, let's add some context. And if you could share your superhero origin story, if you will, how you got started and how you got into talking about this concept.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it goes back a really long ways for me, which is, you know, I've always been an athlete and a, you know, sports fan. And growing up, I played every sport, basketball, baseball, soccer, all of them. But I ended up being really good at the one sport that I honestly didn't like very much at the beginning, which was like running and track and field. And I grew to love the sport. But if you know anything about running, and I was a middle distance runner who ran the mile, is it is literally you alone in your head, navigating discomfort, pain, fatigue, like feeling and experiencing and having these negative voices that are telling you to quit, to stop, to slow down. And you got to figure out how to get on the other side of them and like continue onwards. So from a very early point, like I was used to, okay, what does it mean to quote unquote be tough? And as I moved on from my athletic career and got into life, I realized quickly that, you know, well, it might not be the physical pain or discomfort. We're all kind of faced with these challenges that put us in that same spot where our brain's kind of telling us like escape, like avoid, don't do this. And we have to figure out how to get on the other side of it. And, you know, in terms of getting to this book, what happens is we tend to write the books that, you know, have meaning towards us that we're struggling with. So in my own life, I was like, came back to this own experience of like, okay, well, what does it mean to, you know, take on hard things or difficult challenges and navigate them? And is there a better way to do it? So it was highly relevant to me.
Yeah. And can you share a little bit about that? Because like we talked about before we pressed the record, there's a misconception about what's hard. People do things and they're like, and I'll give the example from my field, the 75 hard. Work out twice a day. Do you know what that is, by the way? Have you ever heard of that?
No, I don't.
Oh, man, you would love it. So it's 75 days, 2 workouts per day. 1 needs to be outside. You need to follow a diet. No cheating, or else you have to start the whole thing over again. You got to read 10 pages of a book and post a selfie, a gym selfie. And there's a group of entrepreneurs who love it. But you see, through the years, I've just watched people on social media. I'm doing this 75 hard again. And then, oh, I had to quit. I cheated on my diet, you know, it's like, dude, that's not the hard thing. It's like, you're really comfortable with this extreme doing nothing and then going extreme and then doing nothing. And even if you complete it, you know, and it's just like, that's not the hard thing, buddy. The hard thing is really to figure out, how can I do this for the rest of my life? How can I be fit for the rest of my life? So I'm going to try to contain myself here because I have a lot of personal stories about it. What's that?
No, I was going to say, keep going. I love it. I mean, I love it because it gets at the central part of the, you know, the theme that I was noticing too, is that we often, it's not that we don't give effort. We're often good at doing difficult things. But what happens is we give effort to things that don't really matter or don't really make a difference in the long run. So that example there, and I'm going to take us down this tangent because it's perfect and it encapsulates stuff, is that's like the athlete who goes and posts their crazy workout on Instagram and says, like, look at this thing I did. Like, I went until I threw up, what have you. But then the next day and the next week and the next month, and then for the rest of their career, they're not like doing the consistent work that actually leads to gains. And I think what you're getting at with this 75 hard is it's like, whoa, buddy. Like, it's not about these 75 days and then be like, I made it. And then I'm going to go back to nothing, like the nothingness. It's how do I figure out consistently over the long haul to do the difficult things that actually matter in my life, that actually have meaning and actually make it difficult. And when you look on the time horizon, like that is really the hard thing. The posting your workouts and doing your diet for this constrained time, that is not the difficult thing. We can all kind of force our way to make it through it, but it's not about forcing your way to make it through it. It's finding how to make it sustainable and part of who you are for the long haul.
Yeah. And that's, I feel like, at least in my industry, that's not an easy sell. If I that's what I sell, for lack of a better word. But when I see the people who are really crushing it financially, it's like keto. You know, here fasting, just the harder, the better, the more strict. And and then you see, and then people wonder why, like, oh, well, I ended up gaining the weight back. And then they'll say something like, I just need to go back to that whole 30 where it works so well for me. And then I'm like, but if it works so well, why aren't you still doing it? I don't understand, right? And it's just this on and off again. And what I ended up realizing, it's just the comfort zone for people. So you talk a lot about this in your book. Your book's awesome. I wasn't sure how it was going to go down when I first started listening. And then what I hear the main theme, I'm not all the way done yet because I really have been taking it in. I love these types of books that talk about like this really philosophy, but it's about managing our stress is a big component. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Because here's what I think. Like, stress tends to do a couple different things. It tends to narrow us, and it tends to focus us on the danger or the thing that is like stressing us out. And it tends to also push us towards like safety, comfort, and et cetera. So a lot of managing your stress in this regard is like, how do you like approach it in the right way and then get comfortable with understanding what that stress is so that you can like sit with it and experience it instead of seeing it as like, again, this enemy that I often need to push away. Because we're all going to experience stress in our lives. There's no escaping it. But we can either have like a negative experience out of it or a positive experience. And I think, you know, going back to that, the hard 30 and 75 and all that stuff is what often happens is we can manage that stress over a confined period of time.
Right.
It's like me saying
not that hard or easier, right. Let's say.
You know, it's easier to do that because we know where the finish line is. But in life, there's one finish line, I guess, and it's when we're dead. But it's a very long, you know, race, to use, you know, another analogy. And I think when we have those confined periods, there's two things that happen with handling stress. And if we look at motivation as well, is often those challenges, let me use this as an example, they do two things. They allow us to see that we can make progress. They allow us to have this finish line, actually three. And those two things together can like stoke our motivation, but they're often from what I'd call like an external end, meaning the outcome is the motivation. But the outcome at some point is going to become more difficult and difficult to experience and accomplish, which is why diets often fail, right? We can stay in them while we're maybe losing our weight and like our body's looking different, but that's only a very constrained period of time for most of us. And then we're going to get to this kind of steady state, you know, defined zone. And we're going to lose that external motivator because we're not changing, we're not seeing progress. And that's why if you look at the psychology and research for handling stressful events or stressful moments, like the internal motivators are much better. And the analogy or comparison I'd use here is those external motivators are essentially like lighter fluid. They look great. They have a big flame, but it burns out really quickly unless there's something else to like kindle it there. Mm. What we want are like those long lasting, not as like, you know, fun to look at, like slow burning coals, essentially. That's what that internal motivation is that will keep us going through the long haul.
So many things are coming up for me while you're talking. I just want to say this in case anybody, I think the idea with the diet, it's very easy to connect with for people listening to this show because it's one of our main focuses. But even thinking about relationships, that honeymoon period where it's like, everything's great, you're having sex all the time, everything's just fantastic. And then it's like, you start to realize it's more of a, like an ongoing process, right? There needs to be like some maintenance and it takes work to do that. And what I would ask you for any type of situation or new job or starting, I remember when I started my podcast, I was, oh my God, the first year was amazing. And then it turned into like, I still love doing these, but it turned into this, oh my gosh, the honeymoon wears off and you're like, oh, I got to make this make money so it can be self-sustaining. And so what have you learned about how to keep things going when that lighter fluid wears off? How do you keep the kindle going?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's something that we all struggle with. But if you look at, again, the psychology and research, it kind of simplifies it to a couple different things. Is A, you want to do or pursue the activity mostly from a point of what I'd call like a mastery mindset. Mm. Meaning, yes, like you want it to succeed. Yes, you want to make the money, et cetera, because that allows you to do it. But you're doing it almost as like that craftsman trying to master the craft. Again, not all the time, but let's say at least 51% of the time where it's like, I'm pursuing this thing because it challenges me and, you know, and helps me grow and live and adapt in a positive manner. So that's number one. The other thing that is really important to developing that long-lasting motivation is what we call autonomy, which is essentially feeling like you can make an impact, like you have a sense of control over what you're doing, and not that it's just kind of from the outside being dictated and demanding. And this is actually where where a lot of burnout in the workplace comes from, is people feel like they're micromanaged and have no sense of autonomy, meaning they don't feel like they can impact anything in a positive direction. So they essentially default to, well, what's the point mode? Like, why try? And we often blame them like, oh, your motivation's not there, but it's their environment that is creating this constricting and controlling place that kind of holds them down. And then the last thing that is really, or the last two things that are really important for this long-lasting motivation are a sense of belonging. So do you feel connected to the work, to others in your community? Like, it's more than just you alone out there doing this and trudging through this. And if you feel that sense of belonging and connection, you're going to have that more positive, you know, motivation. And then the last part, which I'll just kind of combine into purpose and meaning, is the thing meaningful? Does it provide direction in your life? Does it have some purpose that, again, is not just, hey, you know, to make some dollars, which can be part of it, but more so like that it brings something positive to your life, that it's like, you know, driven by something that is important. And often people ask, well, how do I find this? To me, it's going back to why you started the thing, because often our meaning and purpose was like really high at that point when we got interested in it, because we didn't know that we could make money at this or, you know, what have you, is really going back to the point of like, well, why did I get into this? What was the purpose behind it and the meaning behind it? And does that still hold? And if it does, like reminding yourself of that can go a long way for enhancing that motivation.
Yeah, very interesting. Another thing that comes to mind from some of the experiences, so I coach mostly entrepreneurs or other very busy professionals with fat loss. And you'll see, this is something I've had to work very hard with my clients about. And you'll see they'll come in, like you said, high motivation, full of lighter fluid, lose 10 pounds, maybe even 15. They feel good. And then that goes away. And so what I hear you saying is, if a person's in that situation, you really got to get dialed into the things that you just mentioned. And the thing that stood out to me the most is like, why are you doing this? What is the purpose that this serves? And reconnecting with that. Did I understand correctly?
Exactly. Purpose is like a performance enhancer, right? If you have, and there's some, I'm going to take you to the athletic world because there's some fascinating research and science in this area where it essentially shows that, you know, if you have a purpose that is greater than yourself, you know, and by greater than yourself, I just mean that it's like, oh, I'm just doing this to make some money or whatever have you. What happens is you're actually able to push further. So they've tested these ideas in the exercise science world where like they'll essentially shock the muscle to see if it still has like juice in it, essentially energy in it. And you can see like how far people can push to kind of complete or close to complete exhaustion. And people will push further if, for example, they're running this race because they're raising funds for cancer research or something that like has, you know, some meaning behind it, or they're part of a team where it's like other people are depending on them and it's more than them just out there alone. And I think the same thing applies when we take it out of exercise to other aspects of our life, is that purpose can provide that guiding North Star to remind you of, well, why you're going through the difficult moments. And this is actually one of the best things you can do is when you're in that moment where you're thinking, oh, I've got to quit or what have you, is create space for that perspective to remind you why you chose to do this. Because if you chose to do this, then it's your brain almost gets that special kick where it's like, oh yes, I'm not trapped. I'm not like a prisoner being tortured here. I chose to do this. Well, why did I choose to do this? Because, you know, for whatever reason, this is the journey I wanted to take and explore. And that will, again, give a little bit more of that motivation and boost so that you can handle the really difficult thing. And one other thing that I'd say here that is kind of connected to this as well, as I mentioned, like that being part of a team, is, again, there's some fascinating psychology that shows when we're with other people, or supported by other people, the difficult seems more manageable. And there was this fascinating study where they took people and they essentially put them in an fMRI brain scanning machine to look at their brain. And there were spouses. And it was when it was the one, let's say the wife alone in the machine, what they would do is they'd introduce something stressful. Like they'd put a snake in a small cage, like right next to the head of the person to make them like scared and freak out. And you could see it in their brain. Their brain fear center would go through the roof. When they took the spouse of the person and put them like next to the person in the machine so that wife and husband were standing next to her and holding their hand often, the fear response center doesn't go as high. It's just like a little blip. Why? Because when we feel supported and connected, we interpret that stress differently. We say, okay, by myself, this might be overwhelming, but it's okay. I have others around me who can support me. And the same thing occurs, you know, similarly, just briefly, when they took people, same thing, wife, spouse, teammate, all this stuff, and gave them like a really heavy box to lift. When you're alone, you guess that that box weighs, I don't know, 200 pounds. When your husband is standing next to you or your partner is standing next to you, you guess the box is 150 pounds and you literally judge it as easier to lift. And your husband or wife or spouse isn't helping you. They're just standing there. And I think that sends such an important message, which is if we want to tackle difficult things, like have that community, have that connection, have that support, because that will literally change how you see the stress that you're experiencing.
So powerful. And wow, brings up so many things. There's also another study where like a baby monkey had a fake mother and was able to like, went. Are you familiar with that study? My business partner showed it to me recently. And could you give that example? Could you talk about it?
Yeah, exactly. So there was a study, and I think this is the one you're referring to, but like there's been a lot of them, but there was there was essentially what happens is like researchers found that, you know, with monkeys, like the mom or being there was so important for the connection and belonging. And when they took that away, like they would literally have these like fake kind of puppet moms essentially. And that would be the replacer for the connection where it created that sense of security and they would bond to this thing just to have something to bond to and then be able to like handle stressful experiences. And what's really interesting is in human research, this has actually long been studied and it's called like, I believe it's attachment theory, which essentially says that when we form a secure attachment with people around us, like we feel less stressed. We're more likely to take, you know, calculated risks when we feel what's called an insecure attachment, which is we don't know if we're going to have that support. We don't know if we're supported. We don't know if we're going to be punished. We kind of shy away. We experience the stress more so. We don't take risks. And this applies readily in the workplace and office place, especially for leaders, where if you think about it is, what kind of environment are you creating? If you create an entirely fear-based environment, you're actually making your workers like less resilient and less tough because they're going to be responding in this like insecure attachment place. Well, if you create an environment that has what we often call like psychological safety, which is essentially, I feel secure enough to take calculated like positive risks and that I'll be supported in doing so, we feel more comfortable taking on difficult projects and we're more creative.
This is so powerful because just like in business where there's a lot of strategies you can implement that are successful or in health where you can implement a lot of different strategies, people can't implement them effectively when there's too much stress in their life is what I've seen. And so half what I do with my clients when it's that type of situation is what you might call stress, like coaching on stress reduction. And then it's so funny to watch sometimes where even a client recently was telling me, oh, are you sure that there's not something wrong with my insulin levels or hormone? Or he just gave a complicated physiological reason for maybe why he was struggling. And I was like, this is all stress related. Let's just don't believe me. Let's just use this as a hypothesis, test some things to reduce your stress, and then see what happens. And then you saw the scale started dropping again, right? And he was able to, what happens with stress too, we don't take risks. We think we're on top of things, but our memory isn't so good because we're so focused. Like you said, stress is great for focusing you, right? But it's not so good for helping your short-term memory or any of the other executive functions. Impulse control, you're thinking, well, I got to get this proposal done. Oh gosh, I'm really stressed out, and let's reach for a glass of scotch or some food and just keep going out. And so I'm what I'm trying to get at here is just people, I'll say it like this, Steve, one of my mentors in business said, listen, Ted, you talk about stress, people don't even realize there's a connection there. And for me, being healthy or managing health, it's all about stress management, how we deal with stress, what ways we deal with it. And I don't think people get that. Do you see people understanding this, or is your book like the first time that people are hearing about like how stress might be more than just like something in their head, an idea in their head?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think it is. I think what you and I and others are trying to do is change the conversation on that. Where it is like, often I think people, let me step back. When you think of stress and you think of like, oh, this is just in my head, what that tells, it often tells people is like, oh, I should just like tough through this, or, you know, just like it's only stress, when they don't see the like actual physical and psychological ramifications that come from this and through this. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at in this book a lot, is that, you know, we need to like understand and appreciate, like you said, the stress that can occur, and then figure out, okay, is this something that I can decrease and deal with or like alleviate? Or is this something that, you know, often is like, okay, I can't eliminate this stress, so how do I navigate this in a productive and positive manner? And that's where that conversation, I think, needs to head and go more.
Yeah. And if you're listening right now, you really want to get this book. I'm thinking about like making my clients, or at least some of my clients for whom it's especially relevant, to read it, because people in general just have these beliefs about stress, or that it's not that important. It's just about what you do. And then when things don't work out, it's this complicated, like in the fat loss example I gave, it's like maybe something's wrong with my metabolism, which there's nothing wrong. So the book is called Do Hard Things: Why We Get Resilience Wrong and the Surprising Science of Real Toughness. And you can find that on Amazon. I'm an audiobook guy, so I've been listening to it during my walks. That helped me with my stress, by the way. It's one of my favorite things to combine, is walking on the treadmill at a low intensity, or walking outside, listening to an audiobook. And this has been such a great book to listen to, because it talks about the real challenges that we're facing and we're not acknowledging. And we also have some mistaken beliefs. And that's what I want to kind of shift to, because you use a lot of examples from of fake toughness. Can you talk about why we get resilience wrong and what fake toughness is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, similar to what we just talked about, stress, is that toughness, often we have these wrong ideas. We have this idea that it's like the external, often. It's like the bravado and talking a big game and like posting, as we talked about earlier, like the crazy workout we did on Instagram or what have you. But a lot of that is, it's the cheap stuff. That's talk. What really matters is what's inside, in this like internal strength or inner strength, to be able to tackle and do the difficult thing over the long haul. And to me, that is different than what I'd call the fake stuff is. So a lot of this book is like, okay, if we realize and recognize what fake toughness is, then what is inner strength? And to me, it's being able to, you know, if I was to simplify it, it's feeling any sort of discomfort, anxiety, or stress, and then creating the space to navigate it instead of just saying, hey, I'm just going to try and bulldoze my way through and grit my teeth and, you know, get on the other side of this. And you see this all the time in sport, right? It's this, it's athletics where they tell you, hey, like, you know, no pain, no gain. It's when they say, you know, ignore your emotions and feelings, like forget all that stuff, just bulldoze ahead. It's when we do crazy exercises for no point except for like punishment instead of exercises to get better at what we're trying to get better at. So to me, again, it's like, how do we redefine this toughness to do what we all want to do, which is like handling difficult moments and challenges in a productive way that leads to growth?
Yeah. There's sometimes where we need to compartmentalize. And like, for example, I was sitting in the dentist chair the other day getting my tooth drilled because I chipped it eating like some oysters. There was like some shell and something. So I had to sit there and white knuckle it through the process. Thankfully, it was only 20 minutes. And it wasn't so like, you know, it was just extremely uncomfortable. Or a more extreme example might be, you know, someone in battle, maybe that's not in a gunfight, you don't want to stop and like talk about the feelings that are coming up for you because you're in a gunfight, right? But most of the time, and most of us don't find ourselves in those extreme situations, but we have that sort of reaction to it. And I don't know what the cultural history is of, you know, toughness, but I assume some of it at least comes from, you know, the World War II times and the, right? Like I'm in martial arts, and a lot of the martial arts training, which has, which I got so frustrated with because it's like, hey, we're going to beat the shit out of you. If you survive, you're going to be a black belt and you'll be, and it's like, wait a minute, my joints hurt. I don't even see myself making it. And I have the psychologically, I'm tough enough, but there's something wrong with this process. And then I started realizing a lot of this martial arts training comes from the way they prep people to go to war. And maybe that's important. Maybe you don't care about your knee when you know, the world is on the line, but if that's not the case, we need a better approach.
Exactly. I'm glad you brought that up. And so much, if you look at the history, so much of our ideals come from the military. And often what we did is we took the wrong lessons from them. Because often the crazy, you know, things they did, you know, to quote unquote be tough, well, A, is often they occur when they're like initially sorting people. Meaning like, hey, can you handle and make it in the military or not? Because we want to make sure that you can make it. So it's not a development exercise. And if you looked at how often, especially in the US now, how we develop some of these skills in the military, it's completely different than throwing people into the, you know, against the wall and seeing if they break or not. And the other part is, again, often these ideas come from like older military. So it's like World War II. Well, why were people just trying to do throwing it against the wall? Well, it's because we have this draft. We need people. Like, we got to train them up really quickly because we're in the middle of this war that, like, literally could be the end of the world. That isn't the reality for most of us. What we're more concerned about is how do we develop these skills and these abilities? So, for example, in that martial arts, it's not, hey, I want to find the one or two people who can make the black belt. In the real world, it's, I want to make sure that everybody can like improve and develop to reach their potential, whether that's a black belt, a brown belt, yellow belt, whatever their end ceiling is. I don't just want a couple of the eggs to survive when I throw them against the wall. And I think when we reframe like toughness as the skill that we can develop in that, hey, I don't know like where your incapacity is, but here are the tools to do so to get better at it. Then we're in a much better frame of mind than if we just say, hey, the strongest survive and like forget about all the rest of you. And what actually happens is we lose some really good people. So, you know, maybe to tell a story from the book is there was, you know, there's a famous football coach named Paul Bear Bryant, who was famous for his coaching at Alabama. But before he was at Alabama, he was at Texas A&M. And he put these athletes through this like training camp from hell, which was essentially like, I'm going to make you do crazy, difficult things in the heat, no water, all that good old school stuff. This was the 1950s. And whoever survives is going to, you know, you're going to be tough and we're going to win. And the story, the legend goes, like, he did this and then they became a great team. What the legend often leaves out is that that year they only won one game. They sucked. They were horrible after it. It wasn't until a couple years later where they got good, mostly because they got better players. Only like seven or so players were left on the team that went through the really hard camp that they then didn't do afterwards. But the other interesting part of this story that I think was fascinating is we often have this view of, oh, the people who don't make it, who don't survive, they're weak.
Right.
But I went back and I looked in this particular case and I looked, well, who didn't survive? There were guys who went on to play in the NFL who quit. There were guys who changed sports who became like, you know, baseball stars for Texas A&M who quit. There was literally a war hero who went on and became this like ace fighter pilot and then commander in the Navy who, you know, didn't survive the camp. So it's not that they were weak. It's that they probably said, you know what? This sucks and isn't utilizing my talents in the best way. I'm going to go find another area where I can, you know, utilize this talent without being miserable. And I think that's often what happens in the workplace too, is we think like, oh, I'm going to be a jerk and like toughen these people up. Well, if they're talented, they're going to be like, well, why am I suffering through this? I'm going to go find something that like allows me to thrive. And you've just lost someone talented who could have, you know, helped your company or organization.
I remember a client that I worked with who is having some trouble. I got along with the guy, but he had a 600-person, billion-dollar company. And the way he talked about his employees, it was like, man, what's going on? You could tell he led by an iron fist. And I remember him getting really frustrated because he was losing some key people. One of them left to Facebook. And it's like, he tried to like keep him by paying him more money, but the guy wanted out and it was because of the environment. And Steve, I remember that part from your book and it's a really important part. And some of us people think they're doing the right thing by being tough and the intention may be good, but the reality is you have to look at maybe your approach needs to be upgraded. And maybe even the doing the hard thing would be to take that hard look at yourself and your approach and be honest about it instead of just kind of going with that comfortable narrative like, hey, if they're really tough, they'll survive. Yeah,
exactly.
I think you're
spot on, because this is often the hardest thing is actually like dealing with our own bias and getting out of our own way. Which often we get in our own way by sitting there and being like, okay, you know, it's their fault, my employee's fault they left, or I'm not going to evaluate how I lead or the environment that I create, because that would mean like, oh, you know, maybe I'm not doing everything perfect or what have you. So often that hard thing is that introspection. Is can you take the time to like look at the items that you're doing and seeing if that is leading you down the path in the right direction? And I also, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't comment on that story you told of the person that, you know, lost someone to Facebook. Well, what did they do? They tried to throw more money at them. And that is often the solution that we use. And we think, oh, I'm going to throw money at them and this will solve everything. But often that's the easy path. Why? Because like, yeah, it's money and it hurts the company maybe a little bit, but there's nothing you have to change. You're essentially saying, hey, here's some money. And what it doesn't do is it doesn't look at the problems underneath. Why is this person choosing to leave this company who presumably has already enough money to live a pretty good life because they're in this field and all this good stuff? why are they choosing to do that? Maybe it's because the money, yes, it matters to a degree, but the underlying motivators and the supportive environment and the environment where someone feels like, yeah, they can be challenged, but they're challenged in a way that allows them to grow as in both in the job and as a person is more important. So to me, if you're leading an organization, is how do you create that environment that allows people, yeah, you're going to take on difficult challenges. Yeah, you're going to like, you know, do crazy hard work, but you're doing it in a way that is supportive instead of, you know, this threatening and controlling, which again, threatening and controlling often puts us in, to use the sport analogy, it puts us in a place where we start playing not to lose instead of playing to win. And we want people to be able to play to win.
Yeah. And that's what I love about the whole theme here. This isn't about being nice. Let's all be nicer and more kind. I mean, sure, that's important. But to put the morality aside or however you want to talk about it, this is about getting better results. And, you know, I want to return to your story about the military, because one of the things you talk about in the book, it's like, we have this story about what the military does to make their people super tough, but that's not actually what they're doing. Can you talk about like the types of training that the military is using now to develop elite warriors, to elite soldiers?
Absolutely. And I think this applies because I think what we have, as you said there, is, and as I talk about in the book, is that we have this image of the military, almost it's like the 1940s military, where you just like, they go do crazy things, we put them through hell, and then they survive, and that's how we train them. That is not how the military develops this resilience and this toughness. If you look at it, it's very strategic. The military is actually the nation's largest employer of sports psychologists. Why? Because they want to do things correctly and work on this mental game. How do they do that? Well, first they teach before they train. So they teach their soldiers the skills in which they need to know to navigate the extreme situations they're going to deal with. So in most cases, depending on the branch, they literally have like a 400-page book on like the mental and psychological skills, which can be everything from the mindset you take to what to focus on, where to shift your attention under a very stressful environment, to like how to like deal with and withstand maybe being captured and tortured. Like all of those mental strategies are in there to give people the tools. And then what they do is they don't just say, okay, you read a book, we showed you some PowerPoints, we taught you some things, go do it, or good luck. They then put them in situations where we're like, okay, we're going to train you up. So we're going to put you through simulated maybe survival training or simulated training where, you know, you're out there with the team in the woods and just kind of on your own and you got to figure things out, or even simulated, again, like, you know, prisoner of war situations. And they go through and they have their team like looking and evaluating as you go through this. How will people experience it? And often it's really difficult. It feels real. But that's what they're going to encounter in the real world if they are in those situations. And then after, so you go through this situation, they call it essentially stress inoculation, where mm-hmm. you're experiencing stress and then you get used to and adjust to it. And then afterwards, the most important part is they review it. Where did you go wrong? You know, what can we improve on? Where were your mental and psychological skills lacking a little bit? So it creates this environment for growth and development. And the other thing I'd say on this military, which I found fascinating, is early on when they just kind of start this process, the number of, again, military soldiers, elite operators who experience like what psychologists call disassociation, which is essentially when your mind kind of freaks out and you're in this kind of like crazy fog of war state and stress. Something like 96% of soldiers experience that the first time they get in that situation. So it's not like they're innately good at this and have this right. talent. What happens is the military says, okay, you're human. Like none of us are super soldiers. We're all going to experience this. now let's work so that you can navigate this. And we're going to teach you, give you the tools, put you through difficult things, but also review and evaluate so that you can learn, adapt, and grow.
Yeah, if you want to perform like a superhuman, you need to recognize the limitations of being human first and work on those.
Exactly. And I think that's something that we often get wrong, is we think like, oh, the best of the best, like they're just gifted and superhuman. And it's like, no, they have to come to terms with it. And actually, I was talking with, you know, someone who went into the special forces, and they put it very clearly. They said, you know, often you think the people who are going to make it are the ones who are like, oh yeah, on the outside, like I'm really tough. This is easy. Mm-hmm. I got this. Those are the people who fail, because when push comes to shove, it's the people who can kind of see it clear eyed and say, I'm not superhuman. I might be capable and I might be really good at what I'm doing, but like, this is going to be tough. I need to see it clearly. Those are the people who make it through the challenging times. So I think that lesson applies to us as well, as whenever we're put through challenges, can we see it clearly and rationally so that we know what we're facing?
Yeah. I love the talk about the military, because what you got to love about the military, regardless on, you know, where you sit politically or whatever, is that the stakes are extremely high. We're talking about life or death, for real. If a business even goes out of business, I mean, there's so many business. You go out of business, you start another one. Does it suck? I mean, it must. But the stakes are lower. And so, you know, people don't step up and do what they need to do. And I think that's why using the military as an example, or a model rather, of like, okay, well, you know, what do you do to be super successful? These guys, they're employing sports psychologists as per your example. Like, they're realizing, hey, listen, we're talking about competing on a world stage. We don't know what's going to happen. I've traveled a lot all over the world, lived in many different countries. I'm in Brazil right now. I mean, the military is aware of all these crazy things that are happening, and you got to kind of, you can't afford to be lost in a narrative that leads to poor results, because the risk is quite large. And I think that's a lesson everyone can take away from, you know, your examples of the military. Steve, one thing I would ask you is, what are some things that we can do to be more elite? I'm not going to go to BUDS, right? And do some BUDS training just to develop mental toughness. What are some things like I can do, or someone listening can do, or maybe some of the things that you've done to create more resilience?
Yeah. So I think the great thing about this, and the research backs this up as well, is that small moments in your life train this mental muscle, because I really look at it as a mental muscle, which is, we can either, when we take on challenges, we can either have that like alarm going off telling us to like escape, you know, quit, et cetera, or we can train to turn that down, that alarm down low enough so that we can like navigate and make the good, wise decision. And to me, and again, the research and the psychology all show us, which is, small moments matter. So even something as simple as adopting a mindfulness practice can train that alarm. Why? Because, well, think about it. What is mindfulness besides like sitting there with your thoughts and training to like sit with them and accept, instead of react and shift your attention to every thought that comes into your head? And people often think like, oh, I don't want to meditate, whatever. Well, that's fine. Again, the research shows that even a couple minutes a day of just sitting with your thoughts can have a profound impact on this. Other things that I think are important is having something in your life that like challenges you a little bit in some way. Now, in my life, that regularly is often exercise. And I'm not like going to the well and exercise, but it's something where it's like, okay, I'm going to get out the door and do something that is a little bit difficult, that puts me in an uncomfortable situation, which can train this mental muscle. So what I would say is, look for the spaces of the simple things where your mind tends to go to like escape, worry, alarm going off. And instead of seeing those as like, oh no, this is a bad thing, I would see this as, oh, this is an opportunity to train this mental muscle. And try just to sit with it or go towards it So again, you can essentially tell your brain, or your brain learns like, hey, I'm okay. I don't need to freak out. I can navigate this. It's going to be all right.
Yeah. I have a friend who wrote a book, Hunting Discomfort, and it's much less, he goes into the science not quite as much as you do in your book, Do Hard Things, but he very much says like, hey, hunt discomfort. Those things that you feel that are difficult, go towards them. Another friend in past guest, Chris Friesen, who's a neuropsychologist, but he does performance coaching, he was talking about the law of contrasting. And I don't remember all the details that he talked about in the episode about this law, but what he was basically saying is, if you do want to experience less anxiety in your life, you have to train yourself up, because if you don't, you get to a point where, let's say you're doing very well financially and you're doing redoing the floor in your big five-bedroom house, and they brought sandstone instead of moonstone, and you freak out. And so if you find yourself in that place, it's really important to start to pay attention to this and dive into books like Steve's, where it's going to start to help shift that narrative. Steve, based on, I know we're coming up on time here, but based on the research that you've done, how has that changed some of the things that you approach in your life, doing hard things? Can you share a story?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for me, you know, one of the things that has really, you know, kind of changed it or shifted my mindset actually is how I lead and impact others. And the reason this changed is pretty simple, is in the book, I was doing some research and found this fascinating work by a bunch of psychologists that looked at coaching in the NBA. So the highest level, right? And they found that when players played for a coach who they classified as like authoritarian or almost like abusive, like the yeller screamer, like, I'm going to punish you if you mess it up.
Like the guy who grabbed people's throats.
Yeah.
I forget the guy's name.
Bobby Knight. Yep.
Bobby Knight.
Yeah. Throat grabber. So when people played for the people like that, what happened is their performance declined. They performed worse. And in the NBA, their levels of aggressive fouls, like technical flat fouls where they couldn't control their emotion and they just like let it all out, those went up. But what was interesting, and I think the reason it changed my perspective, is those changes, that worse performance and more aggression, lasted for the rest of the athlete's career, even when they were under another coach.
Wow.
So to me, as someone who works in this space, or anyone who is leading, that almost like humbles me to a degree and says, you know what? I better take the time to get this right. And I'm not going to be perfect, but to lead in a, you know, in a productive manner that allows people to hopefully like thrive even when they're gone from here, because you have that lasting impact. And that to me is, again, it's a powerful responsibility, but it's also a powerful message to send as well.
Wow, that is something to think about. That arguably traumatic experience with a bad coach ingrains those habits. And I do believe they can be broken, but it doesn't just happen. They don't just get a better coach and then it magically goes away. It sticks with them. It also brings up kids that act out as well for me. Thinking about that as a kid who acted out against some, you know, I love my parents, but they had some, you know, very different old school, say, approaches. Yeah, Steve, it's been such a great conversation. I feel like I could go another hour. There's so many things that even personally I would love to ask you. But I think we'll save it for part two if you'd be willing to come back on.
That sounds great, Ted. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been fun to have.
Yeah, me too, Steve. And if you're enjoying this conversation as well, and you'd like to perhaps do something hard and challenge yourself to change the narrative, or at least investigate the narrative that you have about what's truly hard and what's not, and maybe how you can be like the military and do things better by using data and, you know, experience, get Steve's book, Do Hard Things. It's available on Amazon. And they have the audiobook available, Kindle, hardcover, all the versions. I'm listening to the audiobook. I really enjoy the narrator that you chose. So that's always important for audiobooks. And if you want to read more about or go to Steve's website and maybe read more about what he's up to, speaking, the podcast, etc., go to the growth EQ. So thegrowtheq.com. Anywhere else you want people to go, Steve?
Yeah, no, you can find my work everywhere. I'm on social media at Steve Magnus. So appreciate it and appreciate this conversation as well. As I said, I had a lot of fun and you're bringing a lot of value to your listeners. So I love the pod.
Appreciate that, Steve. And thanks for being on the show. It's been a pleasure. Are you a busy professional who's crushing it in your career or in growing your business, but you're struggling to lose weight and transform your body while fitting in your social life as well as your work obligations? If the answer is yes, well, let me help you get into the best shape of your life while thriving in your business. Go to legendarylifepodcast.com/apply and schedule a 15-minute strategy call with me today. So that's it for today, my friend. Hope you've learned a lot from this conversation I had with Steve Magnus about doing hard things and how to really challenge ourselves to be aware of what's truly hard instead of doing what we think is hard, that fake toughness we talked about today. I'll definitely have Steve back on the show because there's so many other things we could talk about. But until then, I'm going to be speaking to you on Friday. And this Friday's TED Talk is going to be about how I followed a low-carb diet for 10 years and the reasons why today I think it was a big mistake. And more importantly, I'm going to share with you what I would do differently. Now, I'm cool with making mistakes. We all do. But my intention with this episode is to help you avoid making those same mistakes that I did. It's one of the best ways to, let's say, shorten the learning process with anything, learning from other people's mistakes. So I'm going to share with you why I think it was a mistake, why low-carb diets led me to struggle with fat loss, to binge eating, to messing up my social life because I couldn't find low-carb meals, especially back in the days when I was doing this. I'm going to share with you what I would have done differently so that you can, if you find yourself resonating with what I share in this episode, you can do a better job right away. So that is what I have in store for you on Friday. Tune in then and can't wait to speak to you on Friday.